I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. He's pioneered the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery, which has led to the development of over 30 companies. He is a father of three children and a magician. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Your influence on the biomaterials field is vast, and I'd like to start with the early days of your professional life because, in a way, it helped to inform what you are doing today. After graduating from Cornell, you were a graduate student at MIT, and this was during the 1970s, during the energy crisis. How did the energy crisis indirectly lead you to the field of scientific discovery?
Sure. There was this gas shortage, you know, all over the country, and the gas shortage in Boston was really bad. So there were all kinds of jobs in the petrochemical oil industry for chemical engineers. They were hiring like crazy. Pretty much my colleagues, my friends, that's what they did. They got jobs in the oil industry, and so I thought that's what I should do too. So I went to a lot of interviews, and I got about 20 job offers from different oil companies, actually four from Exxon alone. But I remember one of them in particular, one of the engineers said to me, you know, if you could just increase the yield of this one chemical by like 0.1%, he said, that would be wonderful. It'd be worth billions of dollars. And I remember flying home to Boston that night thinking to myself, I just don't want to do that. It just seemed to me, you know, that I could, there were things that I could do with my life that I thought maybe could help people and would be more important, at least to me. So I started looking for other ideas about what I could do.
Now, you sent some ideas for a chemistry curriculum to various education institutions. How were they received?
One of the things I did when I was a graduate student at MIT is I helped start a school for poor kids and high school, and I got involved in creating new chemistry curricula. And so I remember writing letters, answering different ads to different colleges to be an assistant professor that would be developing new chemistry curriculum. But none of them wrote me back. So the next thing I thought about, since I wasn't doing so well finding good jobs or finding any jobs where I could do chemistry education, I thought about medicine. So I wrote a lot of hospitals and medical schools, and they didn't write me back either. But one day, one of the people in the lab where I was at said to me, Bob, there's this surgeon in Boston named Judah Folkman. And he said, sometimes he hires unusual people. He thought very highly of Dr. Folkman. I won't say what he thought about me. But I wrote to Dr. Folkman, and he was kind enough to offer me a job.
And it was your research with Dr. Folkman that had a seminal impact on what you're doing today to some degree. What was it specifically that you were working on?
So Dr. Folkman had a theory that if you could stop blood vessels from growing in the body, that might be a new way to stop cancer someday, a new way to treat cancer someday. But it was a theory, and actually a lot of people didn't agree with that theory. And what he asked me to do was to see if I could isolate what would become the first inhibitor of angiogenesis, the first inhibitor of blood vessel growth. So that's how I got started.
If you could stop the growth of blood vessels, you could stop the growth of tumors developing further. Is that correct?
Yeah. The thinking was is that tumors without blood vessels will not go beyond a very tiny size of about 1 mm³. But if the tumor is permeated by blood vessels, then that solves the nutrition problem for them, and they can get much bigger. And then, of course, they can also metastasize or spread through those same blood vessels and set up shop in other parts of the body.
You used an eye of a rabbit to help with your research. What is special about the eye of a rabbit?
Yeah, well, it's big, so it's easy to visualize. So what we thought about was if we could have a plastic, a slow-release polymer, that could take anything that was in cartilage, that's what we were studying, and A, not cause harm to the eye, and B, deliver those molecules for a couple months or more, that might be a way to study how blood vessels would grow or not grow.
You mentioned polymers. These are plastics, essentially.
The polymers we use would be plastics. Polymers could also be rubber and so forth. Polymer is basically a long chain substance.
We're talking about manufactured tissues, polymers. What was the landscape of biomaterials when you were pioneering this field in the 1970s?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. Most biomaterials that people used in the body were largely driven by medical doctors, clinicians. And what they do is they would often go to their house and find an object that would kind of resemble the organ or tissue they wanted to fix. So just to give a few examples, the material in the artificial heart, that was a lady's girdle material because it had a good, you know, good buoyancy or flex life. And the material in a breast implant, that was actually, one of them was actually a mattress stuffing because it was the right squishiness. The material in a what's called a vascular graft, an artificial blood vessel, that was a surgeon going to a clothes store and finding something they could sew well with. And so almost all of the biomaterials in the 70s had origins like that. They were sort of what I'd call off-the-shelf materials. And that may solve some problems, but it also created problems because they weren't optimally designed for the body. For example, if you take the artificial heart, the lady's girdle material, you put it in the body and sometimes the blood hits the surface of that and it forms a clot. Mm. And that clot could go to the patient's brain and they'd get a stroke and they die. And obviously there's been problems with different breast implant materials and other things as well.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer, who is the chief researcher and founder of the Langer Labs at MIT. He's considered a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. In the 1980s, you founded the Langer Lab at MIT. What was the purpose for this lab?
My goals were to do things that I thought might someday help and improve people's lives by doing things at the interface of chemical engineering and medicine.
How was it received when you went to the administration at MIT and said, you know, I'd like to form this lab just to facilitate this research that I'm doing?
Yeah, well, certainly my early years of doing the research, you know, a number of my senior colleagues didn't think it was very important or didn't think it was very good, and they suggested that I probably should start looking for new jobs.
Why was it? Because your field was so nascent, there weren't a lot of... Why was that?
I think that people's idea of what's important probably has a lot to do with what they're doing themselves. And, you know, and they had different areas in this department, but this didn't fit into any of those. And I think the thinking was if I didn't fit into something that pre-existed, I probably wouldn't get promoted. I probably wouldn't get tenure.
Since your research wasn't well received at MIT, did you ever think of maybe moving to an environment that was more friendly to the type of work you were doing?
Well, I actually think MIT was as friendly as any place. You know, my first 9 grants were turned down, and nobody at MIT were on the sections that turned them down. In fact, MIT was you know, I still think is a great place to be. If you go against the prevailing scientific wisdom anywhere in the world, you're going to run into problems.
So how did you break through that conventional bias?
Well, I don't know if I really ever did. I just kept doing the work that I thought was important, and I started, you know, publishing it. And I think pharmaceutical companies started to notice it. And they said that they were nice enough to say that the work they thought was very important.
What were some examples of early breakthroughs that helped to lend credibility to what you were doing?
So we had published this paper in 1976 in Nature showing that you could deliver molecules of almost any size. So that was probably the breakthrough, or that was maybe the first breakthrough. But people thought trying to get these molecules, big molecules, through a plastic was kind of like you or I walking through a brick wall.
Even though the plastic was porous?
Well, people didn't know that then, and we didn't know that then either. So the challenge would be the following. You could either have something that would be non-porous that you couldn't get through at all, or anything that was porous would be kind of like Swiss cheese, so you could get through it, but then you'd get through it almost instantaneously. Mm. And what we were seeing was that we'd have these tiny little particles, and yet the drugs would come out for over 100 days. So the problem would be, how could that happen? And that just defied what I like to say, conventional wisdom.
We talk about your research gaining academic acceptance. What was the first example of the commercialization of one of your findings?
Well, there were a couple, but I think one of the early ones was we designed polymers that could dissolve in a certain special way, and what we call surface erosion, kind of like how bar soap dissolves. And what was done in this particular case is it delivers an anti-cancer drug. It's all done locally, so the cancer drug doesn't go throughout the whole body. It just is given locally to the tumor. And then there was a company originally Nova Pharmaceuticals and later Guilford Pharmaceuticals that licensed it and developed it, and ultimately it led to a product that's still used today, actually, in treating brain cancer called the Gliadel wafer.
This is one of the earliest examples of the commercialization of one of your discoveries. Since then, roughly 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed your discoveries. Were you surprised by this torrent of commercial applications for what you were doing?
Yeah, it's hard to say whether I was surprised or not. I wanted people to use it. You know, when you're in academia and you're a professor, I mean, you're training students, which I love to do, and you're making discoveries and findings, which is also what I like to do. But I also want to see what we do get used. I just don't want it to be a scientific paper that just, you know, people read about. I wanted to see what we did have an impact on people's lives. That's why I got involved in the patenting process, and that's why, you know, I wanted to see our things get licensed to companies and ultimately license, you know, create companies ourselves, because if we didn't do that, you know, I find if you're not your own champion, it's very hard to find others who are going to be.
Often there's controversy around tech transfer of universities or academics using their discoveries for commercial ends because it leads to potential conflicts of interest. What was that landscape like for you?
I think MIT, you know, along with Stanford, is probably the top two technology transfer places in the world. And I think their goal is really the same as mine. It's not actually to make money. It's really how can we, you know, maximize the chances of products being developed.
MIT, which was founded in 1861, one of its missions was to provide and support industrialization of America. So MIT had more of a commercial slant to it than perhaps other academic institutions.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think MIT wants to see products created. They want to see things get out to the public.
Incidentally, once a technology or an innovation is discovered and is profitable, it's split in three ways. A third of the profit goes to the department, a third goes to the university, and a third goes to the inventor.
As far as I know, that's the policy that MIT uses, and I think a lot of universities follow something close to that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Langer, a pioneer in the fields of tissue engineering and drug delivery. We'll hear more from Dr. Langer coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder of the Langer Labs at MIT, one of the world's largest biomedical engineering labs, with $10 million in annual grants and 100 researchers. Dr. Langer has helped to launch close to 30 companies, and he holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed his lab's discoveries. We're talking about the profitability of some of these discoveries, and you turn to the private sector for the funding of some of these companies. Polaris is a venture capital company in Boston that has invested over $200 million in your companies, roughly 20 companies. How did that relationship start?
There was a company that I was starting with a woman named Sherry Oberg, and she wanted to have a company that would create the new imaging agents, and we'd published a paper actually in Science that lended itself to doing that. She was a Dartmouth graduate in the business school. She knew a guy named Terry McGuire, and she introduced me to him, and it was probably early 90s, and she also asked if he was interested in investing in the company, which he did. So we've had a great relationship. I mean, like you said, they've probably done close to 20 companies that we've been involved in.
What are imaging agents? You said that you developed imaging.
Yeah. So in this case, let's say you were doing an ultrasound. And for certain things, you can use ultrasound and, you know, get a pretty good picture. But for example, if you wanted to see whether you had a heart defect or certain other kinds of vascular abnormality, and you tried to use ultrasound, the contrast isn't good enough. So if you could create an ultrasound contrast agent that was good enough, then you could see things by ultrasound imaging that you wouldn't really be able to see otherwise, and you could certainly see it with much, much greater detail.
So for instance, if you're pregnant and you go to get an ultrasound, are some of these imaging agents used in seeing the baby in the placenta?
So in the case of looking at a baby, you don't need to do that because I think the contrast is good enough. But if you wanted to look at something much smaller, let's say you wanted to look at I'll make this up, the baby's toe or something like that, and you wanted to zoom in on it, might be very hard to see with a regular picture. The contrast agent might be useful for doing that. Mm-hmm. By the way, I think there are still hardly any ultrasound agents approved, the ultrasound contrast agents approved. I expect there will be by this or others, but it's a long road to getting approval for anything.
You mentioned that these have not been approved yet, and a firm like Polaris has been very patient. It's patient capital, understanding that they might not see proceeds for decades.
That's right. I mean, though they've done very well, as far as I know from what I guess people in business called an IRR standpoint. I mean, I think people in the investment business understand that when you're doing medical work, you don't do it on the sales at the time, you do it on the promise of the company, and that's turned out to work. I mean, an early company that I was an advisor to for many, many years was Genentech, and that came out in the stock market and did fantastic, and they had no products, a lot of promise, but ultimately they did get products, and those products were blockbusters.
Let's talk about the entrepreneurial nature of what you've done. Yeah. You're a pioneer in science. You are also a pioneer in tech transfer, in a way, in commercializing a lot of this research. What are some of the hurdles that you've faced entrepreneurially, even outside of, you know, the development of your lab in the early days in the 1980s?
Yeah, well, I think the challenges that you run into when you try to do entrepreneurial things, I mean, one is always raising money, but two is, again, some of your colleagues won't think highly of it. Dr. Folkman actually said it very well once. He actually got one of the earliest industrial grants. He got about $23 million from Monsanto for his cancer research in the 1970s. And he was at a dinner and somebody asked him, what are the advantages and disadvantages of getting that kind of money? And he said, well, let me do the disadvantages first. He said, there's a gene that a lot of people have that's not expressed directly, it's expressed indirectly. And he said that gene is called jealousy. And if you're a young faculty member, that's not such a good thing because people can control your future. You know, and then a third thing is anytime you try to create any entity, you're dealing with all kinds of people. I mean, with different personalities. I mean, that's good because but somehow they have to come together to create this company. And you have to have good business people and good scientists and good clinical people. And sometimes there might be conflicts. And so you have to try to help on those things.
You've helped to launch close to 30 companies. It's not like you're being Jeff Bezos and you launched one company called Amazon. Here you have sprinkled dozens of companies around in your atmosphere. So how do you think about starting a company? Do you just say, well, here's a great idea, and hey, you CEO with this specific background, you go run with it, and I'll advise? You're like a godfather to these companies more than in the trenches every day.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably fair. I mean, to me, my major mission still is being a professor and teaching and doing research at MIT and training students. But I also want, when we create something, for it to get out to the public. And my students and postdocs, some of them will go into academic positions, some of them want to take their inventions and make a company out of it. And so so if we're fortunate enough to, A, have made it an important discovery, and B, have somebody who wants to run with it, I want to help them do that.
Incidentally, some of the applications for your research have been in fields other than medicine. One example is in the waste industry. Can you describe that?
Well, actually, one of the things that one of our postdocs, Avi Dohm, created was a polymer, but that would help in what's called flocculation.
And what
that means is, if like you have a swimming pool and you have waste or junk in the swimming pool, it could be leaves or it could be dirt, anything, a flocculant is something that makes those things come together. So rather than it be over your entire pool, over your entire surface, it comes together and it's very easy to then remove. And so there's something that company licensed called Superfloc that was very, very widely used.
What are some other tangible technologies that have come out of your lab that we might know of?
Well, we've created fat substitutes that people have used for foods.
What's an example? Like, well, what product?
Like, for example, Hood no-fat sour cream or yogurts. Those use these products. Hmm. I mean, there are a whole bunch of things like that. There's a company we've started called Living Proof, which is in the hair care industry. And also Jennifer Aniston is involved in that as well.
As an investor.
Yes. And so so there's products that the company and my students and postdocs and everybody we've and people at the company have created that can prevent frizzy hair, that can give hair more body. And of course, all the medical ones, some of the companies that we've been involved in, I mean, they've created products that can help people with schizophrenia, help people with alcoholism, help people with diabetes.
What's an example of an application of your discovery to treatment of alcoholism?
So the very first company that I got involved starting was a company called Enzatec. And what we did was make this came out from our early discoveries that we could make microspheres that could release molecules of any size. We merged that company with our downstairs neighbor, Alchemies. And basically that company has created a microsphere that can deliver a drug for a month. It's been shown to greatly reduce alcoholism.
So a microsphere being a polymer that releases a chemical that inhibits the desire to drink alcohol?
That's exactly right. Yeah, it's a little microsphere that you can inject through a small needle once a month. And does just what you said. You can also use that same microsphere to, reduce people's reliance on cocaine or narcotics as well.
We've talked a lot about polymers and controlled drug delivery to things like tumors. You've also spent a good portion of your career on tissue engineering, tissue regeneration. Can you describe what that is briefly?
Sure. Well, lots of times people have serious medical problems where they don't have, their liver's gone bad or they're burned or all kinds of problems where they don't have a tissue or an organ or it's been seriously damaged. So around 1983, a friend of mine, Jay Vacanti, he's head of pediatric surgery at Mass General, he came to talk to me about this. At that time, he was head of the liver transplant program at Children's Hospital. And we started talking about ways that we might be able to use plastics and cells, mammalian cells, to craft new tissues and organs. And that would eventually lead to new strategies for creating artificial skin for burn victims, new ways of creating, well, livers or, intestines. A lot of them are at the research stage. We're also looking at ways of making new spinal cords for people that are paralyzed, vocal cords for people that have difficulty speaking or singing. So all kinds of things like that.
So what is the tissue made of?
Well, the strategy that we use is you have a polymer plastic scaffold, and then you put the cells on it. And over time, the cells make what's called their own extracellular matrix. So all the same proteins, hopefully, and sugars and other things that are in the human body, to begin with, the cells recreate. Hmm. And over time, that plastic scaffold dissolves. It's a dissolvable scaffold that we've designed. So in essence, rather than ladies' girdles or other things, what you're having is what the body normally would have, which are what are called these extracellular matrix proteins and polysaccharides.
So the plastic delivers, it's sort of a platter for this artificial tissue, which flirts with or fraternizes with the real tissue in the body, and they cohere and intermingle and then become their own organism.
Yeah, I think that you said it pretty well.
Hmm.
Yeah. Each tissue has its own challenges, but that's sort of the general strategy that we've developed.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Dr. Robert Langer, founder and chief researcher of the Langer Labs at MIT. Dr. Langer holds over 800 issued or pending patents. 250 companies have licensed or sublicensed the discoveries originated in his labs. Dr. Langer is a magician. I'd like to turn to your personal life.
Sure.
Tell me about this magic.
Well, I've always been fascinated by magic. So from time to time, I try to learn how to do tricks. I mean, I remember taking even a magic class and, I would always love going to magic shops and seeing people do tricks. And I used to do shows when my kids were little. And I remember one time even doing a show at MIT for 400 people. That was a while ago. I'm probably pretty rusty now.
Is there an area of magic that you prefer? Do you like the cards or the body disappearance or what?
Yeah, well, actually, I like the cards. People have often broken up magic into two kinds of magic, stage magic and close-up magic. Stage magic is like the body disappearing and things like that. But I've always liked the sort of close-up magic with cards or coins, but particularly cards. I've always thought those were fascinating.
In a way, magic and chemistry or science seem on the face of it very similar. You have something that, you know, on the surface is wow generating. And your job and your hobby is to understand how to create that wow. Your job is to understand the reasons for that outcome.
I mean, some things could even, you know, appear like magic. Like we just published a paper a week or two ago in Science where some of my postdocs found like this plastic or polymer that can, you put it on your hand and it starts jumping all over the place. And it can even lift things. That's almost magical. And a lot of what we've ended up doing in the lab is understanding better phenomena that is extremely complicated.
How long have you been interested in magic?
Oh, I've been, you know, many, many years since I was a little boy.
You grew up in Albany, New York. What did your parents do?
Well, my dad ran a small liquor store, and my mom was a homemaker. Took care of me and my sister.
What was your home life like?
It was great. I mean, you know, we lived on a small street in Albany. You know, I had a lot of friends. Remember playing baseball and football and things like that. And I went to the local public school, 27. It was nice.
You're an inventor, essentially. At what point did you think, you know, I'd like to be an inventor or some type of creator or engineer in your childhood? Were those seeds apparent to you that early?
They weren't apparent to me that early, but one of the things that I had that I got as gifts, there was a company called Gilbert when I was a little boy, and they made all kinds of great things that kids like to play with. I mean, they had this Erector set, and they had a whole bunch of different ones of various complexity, you know, where you could build structures like a merry-go-round, another where there was like a parachute jump, another where you could launch rockets. And then they also had a microscope set, and they had a chemistry set. And so I really enjoyed that kind of stuff when I was a little boy. And I even like with the chemistry set, I remember mixing different chemicals together and watching the solutions change color, which is magic. But also, it was a chemical reaction going on that caused that. But I never thought about inventing it. I just thought it was fun.
Would you say that you fell into what you're doing accidentally, or was it more mindful?
Well, I think it's somewhat accidental. I mean, you know, I certainly had no grand plan ever. I think the big thing that changed it for me in terms of what I ended up doing was what my postdoctoral work after I graduated from MIT, when I went to work for Judah Folkman, and I was like probably one of the few chemical engineers in the world, maybe the only one working in a surgery lab, and I started thinking about applying chemical engineering to medicine, and that certainly changed my life.
Dr. Folkman compared research to driving at night. Can you describe that analogy?
Yes, that's very good. Dr. Folkman said, you know, trying to solve the problem of angiogenesis or some of the other things would be kind of like driving at night. You can't see past where the headlights go, but you can do the whole trip that way. So in other words, you don't know the answer when you're starting, but you could make steps, and those steps would eventually get you there.
What are some images that come to your mind when you think of your research? You know, when is this driving at night? What about like crystallization? You know, how they have a formation of a crystal and it becomes like this whole network of crystals.
Right, right.
But that's
rock,
my own.
Rock candy. That's significant. I mean, that's an example. I mean, certainly one thing that actually we were involved in. In fact, we started a company on that too, was a company called Transform, where one of the challenges actually when you make pharmaceuticals is having a good shelf life. Because you don't want to use a drug if the drug after you make it is unstable after a month, nobody's going to use it. You're going to ship it all over the world. You need it, and a lot of times you won't use a drug for a year or two. So getting the drug in the right crystal form, that's in the right stability, that actually is a big deal. If you don't get it in the right crystal form, it may not be stable, and then it won't be useful to anybody. But if it is in the right crystal form, it can be very stable.
You exercise daily. How long have you been exercising, and why is it so important to you?
Well, I've probably been exercising probably for a lot, probably the last 32 years, 33 years. It's important. Well, my dad died of a heart attack when he was 61, and, you know, I was 28 at the time. I mean, so I just, you know, want to live as long as I can for my kids and my wife and my family. And
what kind of what do you do for exercise?
Well, I use a recumbent bike, elliptical machine, treadmill, and weights.
For how long?
Probably 2 to 3 hours a day.
So 2 to 3 hours, that seems above average.
I think it's probably quite a bit above average, certainly for somebody my age. But I'm able to work while I do it, and my wife and kids actually exercise a lot. And, you know, we have this gym at home, so sometimes we're all doing it together, or at least a few of us. And so, it is certainly above average.
Hmm. You mentioned your wife. You met your wife at MIT. She's a neuroscientist. How did you meet?
We met on the track. I was running actually outside, and so was she. I knew her, though, a little bit because one of the people in our lab was roommates with her, so I knew her a little bit. But then I saw her on the track, and we started talking, and that's how that happened.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. I enjoyed it very much.
My guest has been the chemical engineer, Dr. Robert Langer. Coming up, we'll meet Chris Barton, co-founder of Shazam. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Chris Barton, co-founder of Shazam, an app that identifies the music or TV around you simply by holding up your phone to the sound. If you're in a store and you love the sound you're hearing but do not know who sings it, Shazam will tell you the name of the artist and the song by making a digital footprint of the audio and matching it with the millions of songs in Shazam's database. Shazam started out as a text-based service before it became an app, one of the first available in the Apple App Store in 2008. Now, over 100 million people per month use the service. Chris started Shazam in 2000 with three other co-founders. He's originally from San Diego, California. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Jessica.
How did you come to the idea for Shazam?
So I actually think that the fundamental idea of identifying a song was one that was very obvious to many people. And in fact, there were actually multiple startups that were trying to conquer this problem and solve it in different ways. All the startups that were attempting this in those days were doing it the way that was the easier way to do it, which is basically to monitor radio stations, and they would tell you the song. So the real breakthrough in Shazam was not the idea of identifying music. The real breakthrough was to come up with the idea of, wow, what if we could identify music just using the ambient sound in the room? And then you'd be able to do it not just for radio stations, but also in bars, clubs, theaters, TV, stores, laundromats, and so on.
Now, this was pretty clairvoyant, not only because of just the technology innovation, but this was also before iPhones and Android and all those mobile devices. We're talking, you know, 2000.
Yeah.
Did you, at the time, envision the mobile industry innovating as fast as it had?
Yeah. I had, at that time, in 1999, when I came up with this idea, I was actually doing my MBA at the time at Berkeley. And I had spent the prior years working as a management consultant focused on the telecommunications industry. So I definitely spent time thinking analytically about telecommunications and mobile phones, and I could see the rapid rise of mobile phones. And at that time in 1999, not everyone had a mobile phone even. As I was brainstorming business ideas, I just thought, wow, all these people are going to have mobile phones. It just seems like they're going to want to do things with it other than make phone calls. Mm-hmm. And actually, at that time in the United States, people weren't even sending text messages on the mobile phones in a big way. That's really, I think, what led to me thinking about ideas related to the mobile phone. I just felt like if everyone's walking around with these devices, there's going to be other things that they're going to want to do. And the Shazam idea seemed like a great complement to that.
You mentioned texting, and that's how your service was initially launched. It was called 2580, because if you dialed 2580 and you held up the phone, then the phone would identify the song and text it to you.
what's interesting about the 2580 number, because it's sort of non-obvious to the average listener, but is that that's a short code. So when you dial 2580, it's like dialing 411 or 511. It's initiating a voice call, even though you're only dialing a few digits. And those short codes are not readily available to companies. So essentially, or to people, I mean, basically the only people that control them are the mobile phone companies themselves. And so we knew that we were going to have to go and negotiate to get a special short code for Shazam. But what's really interesting is that we had to figure out what code that would be so it would be memorable. And a brilliant designer said, well, how about the only four-digit number on the phone that's in a straight line?
Why did you choose to base the company in England?
I have a lot of roots in the UK. My father's British. My mother's French. I have a British passport. And I loved England. I had done my master's degree at Cambridge. I've done my first job in consulting was in London. I loved the UK. And I just thought, wouldn't it be great to start a company and start it in London? I mean, everyone else is starting companies in Silicon Valley. I think it would be, as a life experience, it would be fun to do it in London.
And also, at the time, it seemed like London was more forward-thinking on mobile technology than the United States was.
It really was.
You launched the product, or 2580, in 2002. When did you get a sense that you were getting traction, that people were using the service?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you've hit on probably one of the most challenging parts of the Shazam experience, which is that the number of users that we had from our launch in 2002 until the advent of the iPhone App Store, which was in 2008, during that period, that our number of users were very small. It was in the sort of tens or hundreds of thousands. And so an inadequate number of users to make a viable company. And it's really only when the App Store launched that we finally hit our hockey stick of growth that we've said lead to kind of the widespread users that we have today.
Did you all talk about closing the company down before that point? Or did you feel like it could still motor along at this subdued pace?
I would say that the company came very close to being closed down several times in the period between 2000 and 2008, and it sort of just barely survived. I mean, obviously, you know, it was always trying to make it and coming up with some way to make it another 6 months, another year. I can remember when we had to switch offices our venture capital round, and normally, often, companies kind of upgrade to better and bigger and nicer offices, but we went the reverse path because we were struggling so much, and so we went from semi-glamorous startup offices to kind of former, you know, tax government offices and so on that were just bottom dollar prices.
Other than Apple, who were key people or key events that really helped to ensure the
success?
Yeah, or just the stability.
So one really key event is that we built a separate parallel business to Shazam in the early days. And that separate parallel business was using the same technology. But what we did is we used our technology in order to monitor thousands of radio stations and create reports around what they were playing. And that was something that was actually needed by the right societies that would distribute royalties to artists in order to do it in an effective manner, because they were doing it in non-automated ways using sampling and so on. So we were able to monetize that and even sell that piece of the business. And the cash from that was one outcome that sort of helped fund the business.
You're one of the first apps in the Apple Store. How was that arranged?
So yeah, we had a talented business development person at Shazam who was very persistent. Her name was Katie, and she was out trying to figure out, you know, who are the big partners that we should partner with. Well, it seems very obvious today, but I would actually say that, you know, although the iPhone had a lot of hype around it and it certainly was popular, it had nowhere near the scale that we have today. But she did a great job of really kind of getting to know the folks at Apple and forming a relationship. And Apple also, very importantly in that era, was trying to think about what are the third-party apps that are really going to showcase this device. Mm-hmm. They engaged with us, and we got to be part of their initial launch.
You very easily, accidentally could not have been, if it hadn't been for Katie.
I think Katie is the greatest. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she spotted the opportunity early, and she was really persistent about it. And yeah, so.
By the way, it seems like creating an app is a different exercise than creating a text-based service. even though you're doing the same thing by pulling down audio data? How difficult was it building an app?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because this is in the early days of building apps.
It was, it wasn't rocket science to build an app. But actually, Apple was very good at, for those early apps. They really wanted to make sure, as I said, they showcased the device as being a great device. And for the Apple Apple iPhone to be perceived as a great device, they wanted those initial apps to be great. So they did a lot of hand-holding around a design of those app experiences.
The music database is basically a collection of songs, the names of songs, and the artists. Can you talk to me more about that?
Yeah. So basically, our goal is to make it so you can identify anything. But one of the problems is that back when we started Shazam, it wasn't a common thing to have digital music databases, and that's what we need in order to create the fingerprints that we use, mathematical descriptions of this sound. So we actually ended up having to create a database of fingerprints of music from scratch. And what that meant is that we literally had to build software where you could put CDs into a computer, and then it would fingerprint those CDs and create these fingerprints of the music. And then you'd have to type the name of every single song and the artist. So we actually had, I think, around 15 or 20 teenagers working around the clock in multiple shifts, putting CDs into computers, typing the names of songs so that we could create this huge fingerprint database in order to launch.
And so was a large part of your capital outlay just buying CDs, like going to the music store and just buying as much as you could in the classical area and the pop area and the country area? And
We definitely invested a lot of money in creating the database, yeah. We found ways to do it where we weren't stuck with a bunch of CDs, mm-hmm. but finding a way to get to all those CDs was definitely a critical path for us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Chris Barton, co-founder of Shazam, an app that identifies the song you're listening to simply by holding up your phone to the sound. Avery Wang, one of your co-founders, was very instrumental in nailing the technology part of this. You found him through a professor at Stanford, Julia Smith, and basically asked, who's your smartest student? And he came up with Avery. Can you explain why Avery was so instrumental? If you agree.
Without him, we wouldn't have been able to start Shazam. There was no technology that could solve this problem that we were trying to solve of music recognition in a noisy environment. There were music recognition companies that worked outside of noise.
You stayed with the company until 2004. What was your reason for leaving?
The company actually, as I said, mentioned, struggled for many years, I had been there for 4 years plus, and I just thought it's time to go on and do new things. I ended up joining Google at an exciting time, about 6 months before they went public. They were still like a big startup, I just thought Shazam will be something I can stay involved in at the board level.
And so, you maintained equity?
Yeah.
Who were some of your first investors?
Well, actually, first starting off, we had angel investors for our seed round. And we decided we wanted to get prominent people that would give credibility to the company. So we had Sir Colin Southgate, who was the chairman of EMI, John Preston, who was the chairman of BMG in the UK, and so on. Phil Weiser founded Liquid Audio. And then for our venture round, we had three venture firms that invested in us. That was IDG Ventures Europe. And then two other venture firms, Lynx Capital Partners and FLV. We had to pitch to over 100 venture capital firms before we found anyone that was interested in risking their investment money.
How did your pitch change over time?
When we first launched Shazam, I think we were focused on premium SMS as our core revenue stream. So like literally our model was not that different from 411. You dial a number and you get an information and you pay 50 cents for it. And similarly, we had a business model like that. You paid each time you Shazammed. We then evolved towards subscription and then later towards selling music. We were actually a big driver of music sales for iTunes. But today, the company is very focused on advertising and very innovative advertising. So not just simply putting ads within Shazam, but actually enabling people to use Shazam to connect with the offline world of advertisements around them, from TV to radio to billboards to, you know, anything.
I want to talk about your personal life. You are from San Diego, California. Your mother and father are both professors. Your mother was a professor of computer science. Your dad had a consulting business basically with the aviation industry, helping airlines determine whether there was water in the wings through NRAY, through NRAY radiography, right? NRAYs are like X-rays, except they could look through metal. Anyway, you tell me what he did.
I'm amazed you know all that stuff. So yes, it's, NRAY stands for neutron rays, and they have different capabilities than X-rays in terms of what the what they can provide in terms of imaging. And he focused on a project actually with the Air Force to build a nuclear reactor that enabled the use of NRAYs to inspect the wings of Air Force jets and look inside the wings where they get their honeycomb wings on the inside, honeycomb material, and look for water corrosion.
How do you think your parents would describe you growing up?
Oh, gosh, mischievous, troublemaking. Yeah, a little bit.
You mean that?
Yeah, I was pretty mischievous, mm-hmm. yeah. I would invent ways to torture my sister, for example, instead of just, you know, fighting like normal kids do. I just kind of try to come up with these innovative ways that I could kind of create a little bit of a torture environment. Like one example was that I would put her in a closet, and then I would take a phone that had a cord, and I would throw the phone in the closet with her, and then I would dial random numbers.
Oh.
And she would say, oh, sorry, I didn't mean to call. It was great.
Incidentally, where does the name Shazam come from?
Basically, Shazam is most famous for a comic series, Marvel Comics, where a small kid named Billy Babson would say, Shazam! And a lightning bolt would come down from the sky, and he would turn into a superhero named Captain Marvel. But prior to that, it was used as a word here and there to basically mean to conjure magic. And so when I thought of the Shazam concept of identifying songs, it felt like you were conjuring magic to your phone.
Now, we talked before about how, you know, the traction was sort of a forced march in the early days, and it really wasn't until Apple came out with your app that there was this inflection point. Do you remember, I mean, you were at Google at the time. Do you remember kind of like hanging out on your couch and all of a sudden seeing the popularity of Shazam just escalate? Like, talk to me about those impressions.
I mean, that was incredible. I mean, it was like finally, like, what I had always believed in was finally becoming a reality, and it was 8 years after the fact. Because, yeah, we came up with the Shazam concept in 2000, and the App Store launched in 2008. And I can remember they had these real-time rankings, and I have to admit, for that first week, probably, I was addicted to just watching where Shazam in those rankings. Even to this day, it's actually always remained in the top 100 on the iOS App Store. I just thought, wow, you know, this is finally, the world is just discovering it. But I just was patient and waited.
Are you patient in general?
I'm very persistent in general. I'm not sure about patient, but definitely persistent.
What was some early songs that were Shazammed in the UK that you remember that kind of you hold on to as
some songs that were
were first Shazammed?
Gosh, you know, I can't remember what the popular songs that were Shazammed. I do remember some of the challenging songs that we had when we were first developing the technology. This is before launch, but we noticed that no matter what people tried to identify, it would come back and say it's Brian Eno. And we couldn't figure out why. And after doing some investigation, we found it's because he had the longest song in our entire database. And it was some bug that was leading it to always conclude it was that song. And then we had another bug, which was actually much more entertaining, in my opinion, where one of our venture capitalists would try to identify many different songs. And no matter what he tried, he would get back that the answer that it's the Pixies. And we thought, this is strange because it's only happening to our venture capitalists. But what was happening is he was so eager to make it work, this is prior to launch, that he was going up with his phone right to the speaker, and it was creating a feedback sound with a speaker, and that feedback sound is nearly identical to a Pixies song.
What are some songs lately that you've...
Oh, gosh.
Shazam.
I just love to always put Shazam to the test. So I always like, you know, I'm obsessed with making sure that Shazam has every song. And I really believe the importance of the long tail and the songs that don't get Shazam that much. And I really saw how for Google and for Amazon, that was a critical part of their success, yes, was making everything searchable and everything buyable on Amazon. And so it's been one of my obsessions and something that I've pushed heavily for within Shazam and we've really achieved. So when we launched Shazam, we only had 1.6 million songs, which, to give you an idea, if you had walked into Virgin Megastore on Oxford Street in London and bought one of every single CD, you would buy about 15,000 CDs. So that'd be about 300,000 songs. Mm-hmm. So we launched with 1.6 million songs, so that was a lot of music. But today, Shazam has well over 40 million songs.
And it's still people just using their fingers to type in new songs.
No, thankfully we've moved past that archaic form of music fingerprint ingestion. Yeah, so nowadays there's many digitized databases. The record companies have digitized feeds and so on, so we've come a long way since then. Let's see, it looks like, so if I look back at some of my recent songs that I Shazammed, well, this was clearly falls into the long tail because this song has only had 169 Shazams ever, which is a sign that it's a relatively unknown song. And the song is called Flaming by a band called Scape 11. I also have like Coldplay and Pearl Jam and, you know, some big bands like that on here.
What song Prince. From Coldplay or Prince?
For the Prince song, it was 1999.
You needed to know that it was 1999?
Sometimes I don't know the names of songs, embarrassingly. Like, I knew it was Prince, but I probably didn't know the name of the song. So that's why I need Shazam.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Chris Barton, co-founder of Shazam. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. Tonight I'm gonna party like it's 1999.